Randolph will read the pledge. This is a pledge which says, our job has just begun. You pledge to return home to carry on the revolution. After Mr. Randolph has read the pledge, I will say, do you so pledge? And you will say, I do pledge.
The pledge. Will you stand? The pledge. Will you stand? Standing before the Lincoln Memorial on the 28th of August, in the centennial year of emancipation, I affirm my complete personal commitment to the struggle for jobs and freedom for Americans. To fulfill that commitment, I pledge that I will not relax until victory is won. I pledge that I will join and support all actions undertaken in good faith, in accord with the time-honored democratic tradition of nonviolent protest, of peaceful assembly and petition, and of redress through the courts and the legislative process. I pledge to carry the message of the march to my friends and neighbors back home and arouse them to an equal commitment and equal effort. I will march and I will write letters. I will demonstrate and I will vote. I will work to make sure that my voice and those of my brothers ring clear and determined from every corner of our land. I pledge my heart and my mind and my body unequivocally and without regard to personal sacrifice to the achievement of social peace through social justice.
How do you pledge? I do.
Talking about yet, but I'm gonna tell you soon. It's a pity. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a shame? Yes, how we break each other's hearts and cause each other pain. How we take each other's love without thinking anymore. Forgetting to give back, forgetting to remember, just forgetting a note of thank you. Isn't it a pity? Some things take so long. But how do I explain when not too many people can see that we all just the same? We're all guilty. because of all their tears. Our eyes just can't hope to see, though I don't think it's applicable to me, the beauty that surrounds them. Child, isn't it a pity?
That's a great question. Isn't it a pity? Nina Simone, always, always on time. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, August the 2nd, and by your command and request, your calls, your emails, your Facebook pleadings, we continue the discussion from yesterday. This being the 50th anniversary month of the Great March on Washington, on August the 28th, 1963, for jobs and freedom. And we just heard A. Philip Randolph recite a pledge that those who attended had made publicly. They declared their duty to themselves to go back to the communities and to seriously engage in work that would advance the causes that were agreed upon in this march on Washington. Of course, people had different opinions within the ranks of the civil rights movement at the time, the burgeoning civil rights movement, as to which direction things ought to go and what was the proper approach to take. But there was near unanimity of agreement that there were certain things that needed to be accomplished legislatively. And there was a very important legislative agenda, among them to secure the rights of people whose civil rights didn't even exist at that time, to compel the government to articulate a commitment to that support, which it did in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965, and in 1965, the Voting Rights Act. But those weren't the only landmark pieces of legislation or domestic policies that were enacted in response to this historic march, which is said to be the largest on record in U.S. history. People making real the commitment to a struggle. Of course, we had one approach. This was the peaceful approach. Others had advocated a more militant approach. But in the end, there was shared interest in the advancing of the causes of rights for African Americans in particular, but not alone, not just the African American community, because it ought to be noted that much of what the African American struggle was about ended up benefiting all Americans. All Americans. We had included in this march for jobs and freedom a struggle to end school segregation. Now, imagine, this was 1963, and we still were talking about segregated schools in America. To open up jobs, especially in governmental contracts, especially the defense industry. To open up hiring practices, to compel more even and fair-handed hiring practices. These were not just for African Americans. These things benefited people across the board. A minimum wage, an established minimum wage. Certainly you could credit Adam Clayton Powell for that. Talks about fair labor standards. And the appointment or the redefinition of the role of the U.S. Attorney General to act in behalf of affected communities who had been denied their rights. That, too, came out of this struggle. Yet we see that between 1963 and today, there is a sense that things have ground to a halt. We don't seem to be advancing the cause anymore. We still seem to be lagging behind. And even as we speak today, we have one of the largest gaps between African Americans and the rest of America. Poor people there are more poor people today than there were just a decade or two ago. The line of demarcation between rich and poor, the gap between rich and poor is great across the board. There are troubling signs about the unemployment and the almost permanent underclass right now, the existence of a permanent underclass, and it is race-based, as it was in the 1960s, as it was in the 1860s and the 1760s. So we grapple with this question, how far forward has the struggle come in half a century? How do you see it? And what accounts for it? And how could we possibly go forward as a society from this point where we are as a nation? That's the question that we started to discuss yesterday, and I would very much like to continue because you said you want to continue it too. So let's get the conversation started. 888-874-4888. We had quite a few people still unable to be heard yesterday in queue, so this is your time to make your call, and let's revive the conversation and continue from where we left off yesterday. Now, there's an interesting thing about struggle, and I wanted to caution one caller. Didn't get to do it yesterday, but I wanted to just caution that we tend to dismiss some of these things as being irrelevant, as being not so significant, let me put it this way. But you have to remember that in the 1960s, for this to happen, so many people just showing up, this was a well-coordinated effort. It took a great deal of organization, but it was also a kind of personal risk for many, especially in the South. And we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss this as well as just another demonstration. It wasn't just another demonstration at all. It was part of the continuum of struggle. And there is no one response. There's no one way to advocate for rights. It was a way that many of these organizations felt that they could band together and form a united front in demonstrating physically to America and to the world the inordinate suffering of a particular group of people. Clara, you are on the air from Philadelphia. Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Didn't expect to get on so fast. Hello, Yatrice.
Hello.
Good to talk with you. The reason I'm calling, I want to respond to the question that I, as I heard it yesterday, was why there's such a difference in our response to our situation in terms of action or inaction compared to 50 years ago. And what I was thinking about was so many aspects of it. I tried to water it down here. For one thing, the first thing I want to say is we live in a totally different country. In the 60s, we were still in the throes of what I call the golden age of America. It was coming to an end. I call it 1945 to 1970, when things were on the upswing and the middle class was at all levels, in all races, were making headway. And And by the time of the civil rights movement, we were already in the throes of the, about to be in the throes, I think, of the Vietnam War. And also factories were beginning, just beginning to be closed in places like Detroit, just a trickling of them. And so there were social issues looming beneath the surface that were detrimental to our community at that time. Also, we had a political structure that we could turn to for support. And the way I see it, all of that's gone now. The whole nation's in a state of decline, and we are, as a race, in a state of decline. But I don't think it's hopeless. I think we just have to approach things from a different vantage point in terms of local community action. And I'm talking about things like as basic as growing our own food, developing educational programs for our children. Our schools are being taken. Who do we appeal to? The judiciary, all three branches of government have been bought off by corporations. And I don't know, maybe somebody else can help me with this, I don't know how you can have civil rights in a country where their civil liberties have been shaved off. In other words, how can you have civil rights in a fascist state? And I'll just wait for other people's response.
All right. Well, thank you very much for getting the ball rolling here, Clara. Thanks so much for your contribution today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Michael, perhaps you can address some of that and add to it your own.
Yeah, I'd like to agree with the former caller. I mean, how can there be civil rights if there's no freedom? And how could there be, why should we even want jobs when the first thing they'll do is attack the worker? From 1980 to 1988, Ronald Reagan waged a continuous war against labor and the country's workers. And Reagan fired 11,000 striking air traffic controllers. And they have weakened Social Security by borrowing against it. They attack voter rights with voter ID laws. The Supreme Court weighs in and attacks representations with the ruling about Citizens United. We have the bank bailout, the Defense Authorization Act, and Clinton attacks welfare with welfare reform. And I'd just like to say that, you know, why haven't we made more progress since 1963 when there was a populist surge of progressivist, you know, aspirations, which swelled around civil rights, but also the Vietnam War and a lot of other issues. And I would just say that, you know, the progress in our society has been based, really, this is my, people might disagree with me, but the progress in our society generally on a large scale, if you just zoom way back with the lens, is based on the building of the welfare state, basically. And the degeneration of our society is based on the attacks and the tearing down of the welfare state. Instead of expanding the welfare state and strengthening it, they are attacking it left and right. So every progress we've made from the 60s, you know, you call it a struggle, but I mean, you go out, you legislate, you know, for jobs, and you demand jobs, and they attack the worker, they attack the jobs, and you know, you campaign for voter rights, and then they whittle it down, they attack it. And where is the whittling down come from? Well, I was looking here, and they had a poll on CBS. They said perhaps the most striking poll finding in this particular poll was that a wide swath of Americans see the rich, not the middle class or the poor, as benefiting most from the federal government's policies. 66% of the rich said the rich benefit most, and it was just 67%. But more recently, it's been much higher as a percentage of people who believe that we have, the Americans see their leaders in Washington as overpaid agents of wealthy individuals and corporations who are largely disconnected from the concerns of average citizens. But, if you look at it, there's like a constant attack either from the executive branch, the Congress, or the legal branch of our government against Americans. This is a war against Americans that they're constantly waging, and it's basically to the detriment of the many and to the benefit of a very, very few.
All right, thank you. We'll leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you so much for that. It was a very profound contribution. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Willie is next from the People's Democratic Republic of Brooklyn.
Good afternoon, my dear.
Hello, Willie.
How you doing, beloved?
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, you're doing such an excellent job, my dear sister. Listen, I just want to comment on that lady. I couldn't help myself from calling.
Clara,
yes.
Yes.
You know, what she's saying, what she was saying, I'm in total agreement with her. But guess what? That's what the Nation of Islam has been saying from day one. And we call them racist. And I just want to add something. I just want to listen. I want to add something here. Minister Farrakhan is doing a series on... one-year series. It's like week 28 now, this week. It lasts, you would type in the Nation of Islam, just NOI, and the webpage will come up. Then the screen starts going to the right. The lecture series is the time and what must be done. My dear sister, I think we all, every one of us living in America, should check it out. And listen to what the powers that be, and a man that could speak in that voice, and without fear, hear what he has to say. All right?
Okay, but what do you have to say?
About what? About this thing here?
About the issue. How far forward has the struggle come in half a century?
It seems like we're going backwards. Because back in the 70s and 60s, and we were more together as a people. We cared more about one another. We had organization that was relevant. We had our own businesses. We had our own schools. Things like that. We had we controlled our community. Today, we don't have a community now. What we have now is a neighborhood. A community is one where the people work for the benefit of all. Our community, our neighborhood, we live next to others. If you go to Brighton Beach, you see the Russians. If you go to Chinatown, it's Chinese. Wherever you go, each group, it is they who control their community. Where we live, it's everybody else except us. So it's not really a community. You see, we just live next to one another, in my judgment. And before, we didn't have that. You see, we had control just about everything in where we lived. Not today. So I think we're way off. And that's what I think. I don't know. I think we're just behind time. Because I think we were doing much better then. You have, yes, it is true that you have some of us, few of us, which I believe that you have to have that. To make people think you have democracy and freedom and liberty, all that wonderful stuff. You have to have some of us that has a lot of, because there's some of us that has a lot of money, real money. So But the majority of us, our people are really, really suffering, my sister. I live in Brooklyn, and when you look at, you could see the suffering, the frustration, on our faces. When you look at people, you could literally see people hungry in Brooklyn, So from my recollection of growing up, I've never seen our people in this condition. So I think we're really worse off today. The majority. There are a few that are affluent and doing very, very well, no question. For example, Sister Oprah and Brother Michael Jordan and these people, they got a lot of money. But the mass of us has, we don't have food to eat.
Thanks, Willie.
Okay, my sister, peace. I love you.
Love you too. Thank you. Well, we've gotten some really profound observations so far. So how do we move from this point? Because we can't just agree that we're stuck, or we can't just agree that things are stuck. We have to figure out what is going to be required to move from this point onward, and what is this point onward? What is that supposed to be? What is that supposed to look like? Who is going to do the work? What is the work? And I've been insisting here that part of the work, of course, is just talking things out in a very frank and mature way, letting people understand what the true feelings are, because that's what's the reality. That's really what we're dealing with, not the theoretical, but the actual. What is happening at ground level? We'll take this break, come back, and we'll continue the conversation after these words about other great programs right here on PRN.FM. PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. That was Nina Simone, who has been, in my view, one of the most relevant and most revolutionary singers that we have been graced with in recent times. We're talking about this being the 50th anniversary month of the Great March on Washington in 1963 for jobs and freedom. The crucible in which that event was born, and getting a sense of how we assess our progress, if there's any to report, in the half century that has passed since that march. Eric from Brooklyn, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Eutrice, another lovely show.
Thank you so much. What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking that I feel like the civil rights movement, the ideas of the civil rights movement were kind of premature. I think that was a dichotomy between what Martin Luther King was fighting for and what Malcolm X's vision. And that vision was more was what we should have followed. I think the vision of Malcolm X, where we needed human rights. We needed human rights. We didn't need, we needed both, but I think the first step would have been to get human rights before the whole integration, because along with human rights, there would have been the idea of our rights to education, our rights. So even though it would have been separate, we would have had a chance to kind of uplift ourselves before integrating into the broader, white society, who wasn't also prepared. They weren't prepared to, I'm talking about the white liberals. They also weren't prepared to accept black people, you know, as equals. You know, it was kind of a condescending view, I feel, that they had, where, you know, yes, now legally, we're integrating. Yeah, we're going to set up these situations where you can never advance unless you go through us. And we're not going to allow you to get to our level. So in that way, they were able to kind of whittle away our rights. You look at the prison system. You look at the schools that became kind of militarized, where you had these policemen, you know, daily beating down kids in terms of frisking them and degrading them. You know, it provided an environment where our children weren't getting the nourishment, weren't getting the ease, you know, in which to learn. And I think that if they had been separate initially and we had been allowed to uplift ourselves and get our economy going, get our economic power, get a voice in the society, then the integration would have been more successful because we would have integrated on a more respectful level. I know what I want to say, but I'm not sure if I'm getting my point of view across.
I think you're doing quite well. You're communicating what you're thinking quite well.
So, I mean, that's my point. And I think because we integrated at a point where we had no respect, they were able to further diminish our self-respect by imposing this view that, and it was a view in broader white society that, you know, look at how much we've given them, but they still can't uplift themselves. But we weren't given anything. We weren't given rights. We weren't given economic power. We weren't given the loans for our buildings, the loans for our housing, the programs. We weren't given those things. We weren't allowed to get those things. So it could never been on an equal footing. You know,
I mean, you're looking at it also from the point of view of 2020 hindsight. I mean, you're 50 years removed from the thick of the struggle at the time, right?
No,
so we could look at it in a sense theoretically. But I understand where you're going with your point. I just want to ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Put yourself in that time.
Yeah.
Would you have maintained your same position then?
Absolutely.
Because
I would have aligned myself with people like Malcolm X. That's my stance. His stance was one of, we have to have our rights because you guys will always be able to send in agents that make us feel like we're a part of when you're doing everything contrary. Everything to make sure that we never get any rights. So he was articulating that same philosophy of how can it possibly be equal when the whole, you know, top apparatus is full of your people and the worst of your people. You know, your people who don't want any rights for black people. So regardless of how much we try, when we get to that, you know, anywhere close to the middle, you're going to beat us down. And that's what he was saying 50 years ago. So it wasn't kind of, you know, people were aligned with this. I think it was this ideological, I mean, it was kind of, you know, I think it was a misguided view that, yes, let's march and let's get, you know, enough of them on our side and it would be a happy family afterwards. And this wasn't the case because they have a program or they have this ideology where they need to have the opportunity for their youth. And every time I call it, I make it clear now that at this point, perhaps they will lose enough. Perhaps they will lose enough that they will understand the need for human rights, for the rights of people to be able to live in dignity. And that's what they've never understood because they've never had to deal with this level. Their whole society is breaking down. And who's breaking it down? The same people that were at the top that they allowed to brutalize everybody else. And they allowed it. When they were in their little gated communities, when black people moved into these communities, Those were all people that considered themselves liberal, you know? There was too much of that. So you look at New York City, this is supposed to be, oh, a melting pot. No, it is highly segregated. You go into Bed-Stuy, when they're moving into Bed-Stuy, black people are moving out. Spanish people are moving out. And at the end of the day, you see that it remains a white area. Clinton Hills, you know, DeKalb Avenue is white. It's becoming a white area. Whereas 5 years, 10 years ago, it was black. So you see that even in this so-called uplifted state, there's that highly racialized dichotomy. Hello?
Okay. Yeah, I'm listening. I'm listening very intently, Eric.
Well, I mean, you know, I get, like I said, I get passionate about this, but, you know.
No,
I think
you're making your point, and this is the whole idea. I mean, you're making your point quite well. I wanted to know whether you had considered the dichotomy yourself of feeling compelled to choose either, as you know, people usually do this, you either are in the Martin Luther King camp or you're in the Malcolm X camp. And my feeling is, why do you have to choose?
Oh, no, I think Martin Luther King was coming around. I think that's why he was becoming more militant, you know, and adamant about human rights, you know. And I think that, you know, that's where he became this disagreeable image, because he was actually not, you know, insisting on, oh, let's just keep marching. No, let's make sure that they can't get the money that they want, you know. And that's a kind of militancy. I mean, that's a different version, but he also evolved into this sense that, wait a minute, these people are not relenting. Regardless of how much marching we're doing, they're not relenting. So we have actually, you know, changed from just civil to really human rights. I mean.
But from here, from this point on, what do you see as the way to go?
Honestly, from this point on, I think that things have gotten to a point where if you look at this wholesale monitoring of everything everybody does, I think it's almost impossible to really fight back as minority. You know, so what I'm saying is that, unfortunately, it's going to have to be the majority population in this country, the people, white people, you know, people that have had for all this time and that have had the security to lose enough that they're going to go against their own people. They're going to go against their own people that are at the top, that are making life miserable for everyone. You know, and I think that it's going to change when they understand that a little bit of, you know, what, 80% of black people in jail it can't be. When they understand that having stopped the frisk, I mean, when we talk about stopping frisk, we have to look at the fact that they report less than 1%. I think it was a police, you know, captain or something on your show. And he said that they report less than 1%. So if you have, you know, almost 700,000 people being stopped, and that's less than 1%, imagine what happens every time you walk out of your house in some of these neighborhoods. And I've been stopped and frisked, you know. So, I mean, you can't imagine if you're 17 and walking out of your house, 700,000, which is more than young black people in this city, is less than 1% of how much they brutalize people and make sure they feel unwanted in this city. You know, they're supposed to not ever feel comfortable with walking in the city. That's the message. Now, how many liberal white people are willing to go through that every single day? When they start going through that every single day, then perhaps they'll get the picture. A part of the problem is they have not experienced what we've been telling them is happening. And because they have not experienced it, they feel like a certain amount of it is okay. You know, they don't understand the volume you know, of the degradation. They don't understand it. Now, when they begin to experience these things, perhaps they'll see the value in becoming more human, becoming more humane, regarding other people with more respect. You know?
Well, thank you very much, Eric. Thank you so much for your contribution today. Dara from Brooklyn also. You're on the air.
Please be patient with me because I get a little nervous.
We're all patient.
Okay. My feeling is that nothing has changed because that struggle and that event did not exist in a vacuum. We are living in a capitalistic society. Dred Scott decision is still in full force. Therefore, the system hasn't changed, so therefore, that was a struggle that's ongoing and will continue to be ongoing because of the fact that it's a capitalistic system. Powers that be want to retain power, and they do it by dividing and conquering. That is their modus operandi. It was true that it was a diverse group of people that at that march, and then there were some of those people, in fact, those who benefited most from that movement were not black people. They were Jewish people, women, white women, and they benefit more than black people did. But if you remember at that time, Jewish people had been also discriminated against even before that time and weren't accepted as white people. Okay? And so they benefited by becoming classified as white folks, they became more acceptable after that movement. Okay, I'm not saying that is the reason they participated, but I'm saying that they benefited from it. And also that the fact that the struggle continues is because they have divided the people, they saw that the people were coming together, and they had to do something about that. You know, so therefore, the laws that were passed after 1963, if you would look at them, you will probably see that they took away people's rights and in some cases relegated black folks to the back of the bus. So black folks have never been a priority on America's agenda, and they never will be, because they don't believe that white black folks have any rights that they need to respect. And because white folks in this country were born in this country, they are infected by this sickness of this doctrine that governs this system, this capitalist system, white supremacy. Because they happen to have been raised in this system, they have some of those vestiges within themselves, which they need to work on within themselves to get rid of. Because this is we only have one planet here, and we have to learn to live on it together, or else we're all going to die on it together. And as soon as they realize that, they need to change their hearts and their minds. Because my feeling is that whatever is good for black folks is good for everybody. And I believe that black folks are the conscience of this country. You know, and when we come together, when we recognize what the games that they've been playing with us, that then come together and change our behavior and unite, then the system will change.
But let me ask you this, Dara. In 1963, when this march took place, there was some kind of activity going on at the local level. People were organizing in their interests, and you had a leadership that helped the process. What is happening today?
Well, what they do is they assassinate your leaders. Okay, that's what they do. They assassinate your leaders.
Who are the they that you're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the powers that be. in this country. That's the police state, the police, the government, the FBI, the CIA. We know about COINTELPRO, what they did to the Black Power movement. So, you know, if you look at any gains that blacks have ever made, white folks have always destroyed them. You know, they tried to destroy them or attempted to destroy or co-opted people, paid people off, bought black politicians. And so, therefore, it's always that struggle to find people who are ethical and who do not sell out to their at the expense of their race. And black people have to learn how to have some ethical other so that they have they move and work and with one mind for the good of for all of us. And until we change, they're not going to change. That is my feeling. When we change our behavior, they'll change their behavior. And the system will change. But black people, slavery is alive and well in America right now. It hasn't died. It hasn't died. And black people need to realize that, because just because you have a good job and you got a good car and a big house, you know, just like Malcolm X said, it doesn't matter. You can have as many PhDs behind your name, far as the powers that be concerned, the people who control this system, to them, you're still a nigger, because Dred Scott is still in effect in America. You have no rights that white people need to respect. And long as white folks feel that way and continue doing what they do, and we go along with it, and we acquiesce to it, we promote it, we accommodate it, then we will continue to get whatever we get, and nothing will change.
You're laying a very heavy load here on whites. I understand that, but at the same time, you look at what African Americans have been doing to retard progress, to actually retard the success, to block success.
Well, that is my point. My point is that we have been, you know, there's a division among us, and that division is, that's what they've always done. They divide us according to skin color. Light skin, dark skin, kinky hair, straight hair. You come from the islands, you're from the Caribbean, you're born in America, so you have a different cultural understanding and point of view than the blacks born here. So you can't get together, because those that come here who come from places that maybe aren't doing as well economically as in the United States, they come here and they do well, and they think this is a place on earth. They don't see the struggles that go on for black folks, even though they're suffering too. Once they get a little piece of the pie, they're happy. They're happy. Okay, so they don't rock the boat. They don't rock the boat. You know, and some of our leaders are the same way. As soon as they get promote themselves and start living a life which probably would have never, they've never dreamed of it. And their parents, you know, maybe they've dreamed of it, but they never knew that they could have some of the things that they have. And when they get them, they just go like this is everything. This is everything. Nothing else matters. They have no philosophy. They have no ethics. They're about what would be about. So therefore, they can't lead anybody. They can't lead anybody because, you know, they have no entity. So the people are lost because they have no one to speak for them and to advocate for them. And so in the choices that we're making are choices that, you know, that are not in our best interest. And people who don't know where their best interests lie are doomed. Are doomed.
So, Dara, this is you when you're nervous?
I just had to get this off my chest.
This is you when you're nervous, Tara?
Yeah, I guess so, yes. I get a little loud, too, as well. But, I feel so strongly about this because...
I believe
what black folks need to do. You know, we've been having these politicians that they've been selecting for us, and we've been electing. It's time for us to select our own and get a party of our own, because you cannot select unless you have a party, political party. So that's the only way this system seems to work. It's within that parameter. Therefore, within which we have to work, then this is where we need to energize ourselves and come together and unite around forming our own political party so we can select our own candidates, own people we want to represent us, people from our communities, people we know, our neighbors, people we know who are fighting for us, people who will not sell out, can't be. People have ethics and integrity and have a philosophy about where we should be going, where we should be going. And so, therefore, we need to look to ourselves to help ourselves and stop thinking that these politicians that they put before us are going to solve our problem, because they're not, because they all of them are eating the king's meat. They're eating the king's meat. They're getting money from these PACs and insurance companies and different interest groups. And so, therefore, those are the ones they listen to. You know, so if we can start spending our money and giving it to these people and protect that money and the money that we are the biggest voting bloc here in New York City. We spend billions of dollars in this city. If we could just hold our dollars some sense, keep within our hand, Adam Clayton Powell said. Use what's in your hand. And what's in your hand is your dollar, your money that you earn, work hard for every day. You stop buying that which you don't need. Okay, and use that money to promote your interests, your political interests, your economic interests, your educational interests, things that are going to benefit you, your family, your children, and yourself. So we have to come into a new understanding of how this system works and what it's about. And nothing's going to change. That's why nothing has changed since 1963, because the system hasn't changed. It's still a capitalist system. Bed Stuy is still in effect, and the black folks are still on the bottom, and they're going to keep you there if they can.
Well, thank you very much for your very profound contribution today, Dira. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for allowing me. Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. Well, you can tell that there's a great deal of passion behind the thoughts that we heard today, and so many more still wanting to be heard on the subject. But this is the 50th anniversary month, and it is scary to think that 50 years ago, that's half a century, has passed since a group of people accomplished something. Whatever we choose to think about it, they accomplished something, not for themselves, but for a whole group of people and for a whole nation. And 50 years have gone past us, and we can't really say, we can't account for ourselves and what we have done in 50 years. Which is why I say we can't make judgments about whether they were right or they were wrong to do this, or that's immaterial. That is not even worth discussing. The fact is, they made real a commitment to action. They issued a call to action. They took action. They yielded results. Now, whether the results were spectacular or somewhat spectacular, you're free to judge on your own. I'm satisfied only that they showed leadership. Maybe that's they took great that. Risks at that time. And do we wait another 50 years before the record shows that we stepped up to the plate and did something too? Thank you so much. We'll see each other Monday.
Mankind has been so